Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
If you've been here before, you realize I'm not Tim, right? And he was scheduled to talk today, but has the flu. And so I was talking next week, and we decided to switch. But if you still are looking forward to Tim, you can look at me and think, well, maybe that's Tim in disguise. Okay, today I'm going to continue I'm talking about the six perfections, which I started in December, and I want to just give a little review on what I said. Basically, the six perfections are about how we train ourselves, you know, what kind of path we can follow. And it answers questions like, how should I behave, or how should I live? The Buddhists gave us guidelines called the Six Perfections in Rightful Living. How many people are kind of new to these talks and don't know much about Buddhism? Okay. I wanted to just judge a little bit about how to present the talk and how much background to give. And let me give just a 30-second history of Buddhism. But Buddhism started about 2,500 years ago in India. About 100 CE, or the current era, it moved to China, where it fused with Taoism and Confucianism. And Zen grew out of that, and so a lot of ideas in Zen we have about the nature of the world, the nature of our practice, actually comes from Taoism. And much of our ritual, next Saturday we actually have a half-day session, which is kind of a more ritual. You hear the word session, and you start bowing. that came out of Confucianism. Eventually, Buddhism moved to Japan, and then finally to the United States and the West in general. And it was brought to the West by a Japanese Zen priest. And the founder of this center, Katagiri Roshi, a Japanese a priest, Suzuki Roshi, was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, etc. And so we're kind of their lineage a little bit. And if you actually look at the history of Buddhism, you'll see that there were kind of two practices. That of a home leaver. And if you decided you were going to really commit your life, basically, to awakening, if you will, you left your home like the Buddha left his family and his home, and for 6 years practiced hard before awakening, etc. So that's one practice that is becoming a home leaver. The other basically is just being a lay Buddhist, and all of us basically are lay Buddhists, even though some of us are called priests or teachers or whatever, we're still basically lay people. So the question we have in the West, and that's kind of a unique phenomenon in the West, also the fact that men and women together practice, which is quite different than the traditional practice, where for various reasons they were kept quite separate. So our question is, well, how do we practice in the West? You know, what's appropriate to our practice? We're certainly not monasteries, we're certainly not home leavers, etc. The Buddha gave us the six perfections as a guide for general living. Before I mention the six perfections, I wanted to say just a little bit about, and this is all a repeat of what I talked about last time, there are two misunderstandings I hear a lot in Zen Buddhism, and I thought I'd mention them. One is that no effort is required. You hear that in such expressions as, you're already a Buddha. You know, just sit. You have Buddha nature. You're perfect just as you are. That's true only if you're a Buddha and you have that realization and you feel you're an expression of Buddha nature. And it does take a fair amount of effort and training. And just look at the Buddha's life, Remember, the Buddha trained, and when you read about how the Buddha trained for 6 years, etc. I mean, he, you know, the ultimate effort, etc. So that's kind of Zen rhetoric or Zen speech. You know, you're perfect just as you are. In 40 years from now, you're going to be the same schmuck, but you're going to understand it just a little different, etc. There is a lot of effort required, consistent daily practice, if you will. The second misunderstanding, there's kind of a white-black understanding. For example, you're either a Buddha and you see clearly, or you don't understand anything. And there's little room for a gray area in there. And this is the area where you practice hard. Okay? And a lot of times when you read the scriptures, etc., remember these are the expressions of an enlightened person. Okay? And we don't necessarily understand basically what they're saying. One way, and I introduced this last time, you know, one way to understand this is something called the three views in Buddhism. And the first view is a false view that you don't understand. And then there are two right views. The third of the right view is the view of a Buddha who understands emptiness and dependent origination and all of these concepts perfectly. The second right view is in between, where basically you're beginning to understand, but you don't have clear sight. Okay? And that's where this gray area comes in. One of the pictures that we see, you know, used a lot in Buddhism is the idea of a raft crossing a river. And that expresses these ideas very nicely. Before you put your foot on the raft, false view. You know, you may not even realize that there is suffering, what the problems are. And then when you get across the river, of course, you know, there is awakening. And that's the third view. But to get across the river, you got to pull hard. Pull in the sense of a pole, etc. The more turbulent your life is or the times in which you live, oftentimes you have to pull harder. And when I think of the raft going across the river, I think of the Sangha pulling. You know, this is not just an individual thing. But we as members of a spiritual community, etc., are all there pulling together. And if somebody can't pull as hard, then it's your job to step in and give them support and move across the river. Sometimes, if things are too easy, you get on the raft and you have a party, and the next thing you know, you've been swept down the river and you're out in the ocean, you haven't got across, etc. So that's a kind of an image. And then they always say, of course, if you're unfamiliar with that terminology, the raft, they always say, of course, it was all a dream. Anyway, you know, they say that when you cross the river, you discard the raft. You don't carry it with you. You've used the Dharma to get across. Okay? You've used the Dharma to get across. You've used the teaching. So you don't want to be too attached to it, if you will. The Buddha, you know, given the fact that we're not home leavers, etc., the Buddha gave us the six perfections. And the six perfections, the first are generosity, which I talked about last time. Today I'm going to talk about Buddha's ethics or morality. The third one is patience, which I'll talk about in the future. The fourth is effort, and the fifth is meditation, and the sixth is wisdom. And in Buddhism, wisdom is taken to refer to understanding the Dharma. It's not having the answer to every question on Jeopardy. Okay? That's a different kind of knowledge and different kind of wisdom. And if you think about these six perfections, they're just ordinary things you'd expect about a person who is kind of an ordinary good person. Think of generosity. Well, you know, the Buddha's not stingy, and you don't want to be stingy, right? And the same thing, you don't want to be an immoral person, hopefully. You know, and if you just go through them, that these are just ordinary ways of being for a good person, if you will. So let me just say a little bit about generosity, which I talked about last time. And these are called the Prajnaparamitas, and A paramita is kind of a virtue. And we have a dana bowl over there, and dana means generosity. And so it's dana paramita, etc. But the giving of generosity, and there are various ways to give, which I mentioned last time. You can give material thing, which we do. You can put a $100 bill into the bowl, of course. We have various ways we give things to local food shelves and things like this. So you can give material things. But you can also give immaterial things. And one I mentioned last time, which I kind of like, is the gift of happiness. And it sounds kind of goofy, but this is something that Norman Fisher, who the former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, talked about. When he became abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, people would say, "What are you going to do? What's your program?" And he'd say, "My program is to be happy." And they would say, "Well, that sounds kind of goofy." And he would say, "Well, I was in a monastery with a very crabby abbot, and that was no fun. And if I'm happy, people around me are going to be happy, and they're going to feel good." And this is what people say about Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, the Dalai Lama. You feel good just by being around them. Okay, you feel good just by being around them. So one thing we can do in our practice, etc., is to try to be happy. To try to make life fine for people around us. I also mentioned mindful listening. One of the great gifts we can give people, and we walk around, we can have coffee with people, we can stand with people, but we may never feel those people in the sense of being felt, that somebody really connects with you, etc. And so there's a whole spiritual path of listening, Zen listening, if you will. And there are various ways to do this, and a couple I mentioned. One is to adopt the two-question rule. That when you're talking to somebody, and it's kind of important, always ask them two questions about themselves before you say anything about yourself. And it's just a simple rule. It's one that we can adopt easily and follow. Another way of listening spiritually is to ask, well, what's that person's movie? And there are lots of books on this, and they always talk about what's their movie. And that is, we all, in our head, think certain ways. We think about having interactions in a certain way. We have certain goals, etc. In other words, we live in different movies, if you will. And years ago, I belonged to a coffee group, and there were a couple old guys who must have been 45 or something like that. For me, I'm going to be 74 in a few months, and I think these old guys, But anyway, there was a dentist there who was one of the leaders, and people would come in, and we had one guy who was slipping off into mental illness, and he would come in and he would say, "Boy, I just had a great meditation. I was down at Lake Calhoun meditating, and the bugs, were after me, etc. And I put a force field out, and I could see him bounce off. Obviously he had some problems, And our dentist said, that this guy's name was John. When you talk with John, that's what it means to talk with John. You know what I mean? And so it's the same thing when you talk with anyone. You learn what's it mean to talk to that person. And you don't try to change, the way you talk, but you try to be part of their movie, if you will. Well, today I'm going to talk about the second perfection, and that's a morality. Morality sounds... I went to a Catholic grade school for 4 years, and it kind of sounds like that. But think of it as ethics, if you will. And when I gave the talk on generosity, I said, of course, it's the most important of the paramitas, because it's a gateway to compassion. Okay, but I think this week, today, I think we can say morality is the most important of the paramitas. And of course, I'm going to say that for every one, mainly because it's the very foundation of a practice. It's the very foundation of your practice. It's fundamental to Buddhist practices. And there are various ways that one can practice Buddhist ethics, and the one that's most often practiced is the five precepts. And so that's going to be kind of the heart of what I'm going to say this morning. And the five precepts in their very negative form are do not kill, do not steal, do not, and you're not going to remember all of this anyway, it's not important. Do not misuse sexuality, do not lie, and do not befuddle the mind. That's my interpretation of that, if you will. Now, I might mention that these are considered just general fundamental precepts that all Buddhists follow in the path of morality, that if you became a home leaver, then you would adopt all kinds of other precepts. And in fact, it wasn't unusual to have 150 kind of rules you had to follow, or 220 for women and things like this. Originally there were 10 precepts for a home leaver, basic ones, and I'll mention them just to see what we're not going to do. One was that don't sleep in a luxurious bed. Don't befuddle the mind by attending entertainment. No TV, no movies, no shows, because it distracts the mind from being mindful, if you will. Don't wear perfume or jewelry. And there were some real great ones. Don't eat after noon. And there's some hilarious stories about people traveling across the United States looking for a diner so they could eat before noon, things like this. Don't handle money was another one. Of course, we don't adapt those. And in fact, when Buddhism left India and moved to China and then Japan, it became impractical not to eat more than one meal a day. It was colder environment, etc. Now, these are not commandments. They're not like the Ten Commandments. They're not given by some superior being, etc. They're just suggestions. Over the several thousand years, they've shown that if you follow, if you are this way, if you practice the precepts, etc., it will change your life, and it can change the life of people around you. So it's up to you to practice or not. And if you do, you'll see it makes a difference. Okay, the precepts are based upon a fundamental understanding in Buddhism, and that is that we're all interconnected. If you've taken some classes here, you learn about emptiness. I'm not going to say much about that, but you learn that, according to the Buddha, that we don't have an essential being, that we're all interconnected. And if you think of something like the floor in a wood, and you think, well, obviously it came from a tree, right? And there had to be water and sunlight to fertilize a tree. There had to be a seed, basically. There had to be somebody to come along and saw down the tree, and on and on and on. As Thich Nhat Hanh, the famous Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, says, I look at a grain of rice and I see the universe in it. Okay, so we are all interconnected. And therefore we have a certain responsibility to take care of not just ourselves, that's important, but to take care of people around us, etc. We can practice the precepts on three levels, and again, you are not going to remember all of this, but just to get the general idea, when you step on the raft and you first start practicing, etc., you want to restrain yourself from causing harm. And a lot of times you take a class or two and you say, well, I'm going to do good. I'm going to go out and really help people without really much of a deep understanding. So the very first step is to do no harm. That is, refrain basically from doing harm. And therefore, the precept will say something like, do not steal, instead of saying something support all beings in the world, etc. And then the second step is, you do this with a kind of a deep meditation practice, a mindfulness practice, etc., is that you start observing yourself, and I'll mention this in a number of these precepts, you start observing yourself on, wanting or telling little fibs. You just kind of watch yourself. I mean, it's always amazing to understand, start to realize, well, this is me? This is really what I'm like? You know what I mean? Because we don't think about it. We just live from minute to minute. And so you do mindfulness practices, etc., to understand your wanting, for example, your attachment, things like this. And then the third practice is altruism. You know, you've looked at yourself, you've worked hard on this, etc., and now you're ready to go out and help others, if you will. So it's usually the negative first, and then the positive interpretation a second. Well, let's look at the first precept, and that is do not kill. That's the negative part, the restrain part. And I think when we talk about the precepts, you'll see that they're much more complex, involved, and uncertain than we might think. Of course, do not kill sounds pretty straightforward. The way to think about it in a more advanced way is saying, knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, that is, are interconnected, I undertake the training to protect life. And so that's different. It's not don't kill, but protect life, etc. And so you're doing something positive. Now, and that wording comes from a nice book by Diana Winston. It's called Wide Awake, Buddhism for the New Generation. I don't see many teenagers here, but it's really intended for teenagers. And it's just a great book. If you know a teenager who wants a book on Buddhism, Wide Awake is a great book because she gives all kinds of examples of the typical teenage problems that you run into in high school and things like that. Well, let's think about this a little bit. I would not kill. So somebody breaks in your house and they're going to kill your family. What would you do? You have an old, sick dog who can barely move around. Should you go and have the dog put down? Yeah, well, I certainly have. But you're killing in a sense. So you begin to see the complexity of some of these things. What about swatting a mosquito? And there's probably not a Minnesotan alive who has not swatted a mosquito. I remember I was driving back from the cabin one Sunday and listening to the public radio, and they were interviewing Thich Nhat Hanh, this Vietnamese Buddhist monk who had just given a retreat in Wisconsin. So they said, well, what did you do when the bus came? And he said, please don't bite me. And when it bit me, I swatted it. So some of these are not easy. What about hunting and fishing? Yeah, many of us might think of hunting as killing, but think less so of fishing. Right. What about eating meat? How many people wear leather shoes? You know what I mean? Part of working with the precepts, and I'll emphasize this throughout, is that it becomes a very personal thing. Everybody develops a personal relationship with the precepts, and they have to think about what's proper for them. Say, what's it mean? In what way are you harming that you don't realize you're harming? You know what I mean? And so it's not just a simple thing, don't kill, etc. It involves all kinds of decisions, etc. Now remember, besides saying don't kill, the precepts ask us to protect all life. And so this is the forests and the oceans, etc. And so you become involved in things like global warming. And if you think about these things deeply, before you know it, you're involved in the Buddhist Peace Organization, you know, activist organizations, etc. So where do you stop? You oppose nuclear weapons, etc. So you can begin to see the complexity of some of these precepts. And I'll talk more about some of those. The second precept is do not steal. And that's the negative part. The positive part is knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the training to take only what is freely given to me. Obviously, cheating, it could be shoplifting, cheating on an exam, plagiarism, but it could also be more common things like borrowing a book or a CD or something and not returning it. We all do that. Picking something up from the library downstairs and taking it home without signing it out. You know what I mean? And those are things that even good people might do. What about going to visit a friend and taking a shower and using their shampoo without asking? You know what I mean? And so these are things you have to... I'm not saying don't do those things. I always use their shampoo. But but you can see, in a sense, it is a form of taking without asking, without something that's freely given, etc. There are more serious things that we don't think about, but we share a heritage in. And what about taking land from Native people? There was a cartoon in the Star and Tribune a couple days ago. I don't know if you saw it. It's, you know, one of these old-time ships with sails on it, discovering America. And they were saying, oh, you know, we can live happily with the natives, you know, in peace together. And then a little blurb said, or we could just take it. Or we could just take it. We think, well, that's something that happened in the past, and it doesn't affect us at all. But how do we benefit from the exploitation of another country's resources and their labor? And that's a form of stealing, etc. Now, think of all those people who work in those factories, and some of which have what are called suicide nets around the building. I mean, because it's so hard and so difficult, you know, people throw themselves out the window, etc. But when we go to Gap or wherever we go and buy those clothes, etc., do we think about that? And so we are implicit in that form of taking, etc. And it's a hard one. It's a hard one, you know, to handle, etc. There are many instances of stealing on a global scale. And a lot of this is just part of attachment, of wanting. And in Buddhism, there's something called the three poisons. One is, you know, there are names like greed, but they're also just wanting. Do I want that 10-inch TV or do I want that 50-inch TV? You know what I mean? You know, things like that. Do I want a rattle-trap car? My very first car cost $15, by the way. And it had holes in the floor, and so there were pieces of plywood over the holes. And when you wanted a little adventure, you'd take the plywood off so you could see the road going by. but anyway, or do you want a nice SUV, whatever? And so one of the poisons, of course, is wanting or attachment or greed. Another one is a hatred or not wanting or aversion. And then the third is just a delusion and not understanding, etc. What about the third precept? And the third precept is don't misuse sexuality. And remember, that's the negative short version. Framing it more positively, knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the training to protect relationships and to avoid sexual miscontact. So ultimately, don't use sexuality is really a statement about protecting relationships, yours and others, etc., and not interfering. And some simple examples, don't misuse your position of authority to lure someone into sex. And I think everyone realizes that, you know, how attractive some positions, individuals in position of authority can seem to be. You know what I mean? And in the 1980s, as you probably all realize, there wasn't a single Zen institution, I think, across the United States that didn't have either, usually sexual misconduct of some kind. Sometimes financial misconduct, and that goes on to today, you know, for one reason, and it's a very difficult one because let's say that you're a priest or a teacher of some kind in a place like this, and you don't have a relationship, and you want to have a relationship. You know, how do you about establishing a relationship with somebody who's part of the Sangha without you know, sexual misconduct, etc. In the early 1990s, we had a couple cases like that here where people thought that they were in a consensual relationship, and then later somebody said, you abused your position of authority. You know, so these are not easy things to deal with. You know, I mean, they're tricky kinds of things. Don't have sex with someone in a committed relationship. Another one is don't flirt with somebody if you don't intend to follow through. You know, and this is a little more difficult one. You know, some of these are kind of softer because you look at someone, you smile, and you know you can feel the juices rising, and oh, you know what I mean. And then your wife grabs you by the ear, or the husband, etc. Don't cheat. Are you an ogler? I say that because I go to a coffee house most mornings, and you know, it's right on an important corner with a bus stop over there, and you know, you can see a lot of ogling going on. But most basically, the third precept is about protecting the safety and integrity of relationships, protecting commitments, your own and others, etc. The fourth precept is do not lie. Do not lie. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the training to speak truthfully and kindly, etc. Refrain from false and harmful or harsh speech. And I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it burns inside me. I was on a committee at the Zen Center here, and we had planned to do something for years, and then we had a new person come in and take over leadership, and they wanted to change what we had planned for 2 years. And so I talked in a very harsh way about not doing that, not changing it. I've always felt bad about that, but the next day I hopped in an airplane, flew to Seattle, where I stayed with a good Buddhist friend of mine. He had a big bookcase of Buddhist books, and at random I picked one off of there, and it was something like The Wonderful Speech of My Wonderful Teacher, something like that. And I opened it at random, and it said, if you use hard speech, this is what's going to happen. You will be eaten by sea monsters. And it was coincidence, you know what I mean? But I learned an awful lot about that. And in Buddhism, we talk a lot about skillful means. You know what I mean? There are many more skillful ways I could have done that rather than just being harsh, etc. As we know, lying can cause a lot of damage. But what about white lies? And years ago, in the 70s, I was an anthropologist when I worked, and there was a wonderful book by a cultural anthropologist called The Prevalence of Deceit. And it just mentioned that societies can't work without white lies. You know what I mean? That everyone, you know, it's tact. You know, you're smoothing things over. And I'm sure if you have a committed relationship and, you know, when your wife or husband or partner gets up and you don't say, geez, you look like you were run over by a 10-ton truck, you know, you refrain from, you know, things like this. And so where do you draw the line, basically, on... always being honest, if you will. The fifth precept is called do not befuddle the mind, because there are all kinds of ways that you can befuddle the mind. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, I undertake the training to protect the clarity of my mind through avoiding intoxicants. And intoxicants, of course, can be drugs and alcohol, but too much TV. Too much iPod reading. If you sit, it can even be too much food. Anything basically that kind of befuddles the mind. So, what about some practices that exercises that we can do? One thing you learn in the effort part is that you want to do something every day, even if it's just a little thing. Okay, just a little thing. You know, no one's going to say that your whole day has to be. You know, you're not a home leaver, but what you have to start a pattern, basically, of the perfections and working with the perfections. One way is to talk about the precepts, talk over the precepts with friends. You know, what's it mean to you to lie or to steal or to misuse sexuality? You know, and that's important. You need friends or maybe Sangha members, etc. What needs most work? How do they work in your life? And again, you want to develop a personal relationships with these. Here's some others. For a week, don't as hard as they are. For a week, don't talk about a third person who's not there. etc. I think about that a little bit. I think I do a pretty good job about it now, but it's so alluring. You know what I mean? So for a week, don't talk about a third person. For a week, each morning or evening, read about the meaning and practice of a precept and set your attention for the next 24 hours. And that might just be something simple like, on the negative part, watch how truthful I am. Watch what I say, etc. Or watch the urge to want, if you will. Explore your patterns through mindfulness. And that's what I meant when you kind of sit and use your meditation practice, etc., to watch yourself. There are a lot of courses on the precepts. And in part of the final exam was to go to a store that contained lots of things that you wanted. And it could be cars, it could be furniture, it could be computers, it could be chocolate, whatever it is. And then you walk through it for 20 minutes in a state of mindfulness, just observing the idea of wanting coming up. And it's kind of fun, and they do this as part of their final exam. Decide for a month you won't take anything you are not sure is freely given. If you really watch yourself with mindfulness, you'll see you probably take more things than you think you do. For a week, observe how you experience your sexual energy and how you relate to people sexually. Now, here's one of my favorites. Go out into the woods during bug season. And what better state to live in? And become aware of your reactivity. Do you want to swat? Do you want to kill? Etc. And then use the Sangha. Talk with a teacher. Walk the path with others. And there's nothing better than a wise friend who's also on the spiritual path who you can share your ideas with. Just a few closing additional kind of thoughts related to morality. And one is messing up. We all have lazy times. There's times we don't follow through, what we say we're going to do. And in Buddhism, you don't beat yourself up and say, I'm such a rotten person. You know what I mean? You just say, well, and by doing that, you actually learn a lot about yourself. Why am I not following through? Why am I not doing this, etc.? The whole thing about messing up, we all mess up all the time, etc. There's another part of this that has to do with merit. And a lot of times in Buddhism, particularly our branch, they say no merit. No merit. But there's lots of merit. And they mean something different than no merit. That in our practice, we develop a lot of merit. And if you read something like the Diamond Sutra, it's all about generating merit. The difference between our practice and some other practices is that we always turn over our merit to others. And it's a tremendous stimulus for really a hard practice, is the idea that you're turning your merit over to somebody who actually needs it. There's a board along the wall in the hall out here that at one time was a merit board. And during the day or at the beginning of the week, you'd tack a piece of paper up and say, this week or today, the merit of my sitting and my practice goes towards Karen, or somebody like that. And it's just a tremendous practice. And we have to compare that kind of practice with the merit in other kinds of Buddhism. The idea is that to have a better life, you're constantly being reborn, etc., that you have to generate merit in your life that helps you actually have a better life, if you will. Another concept that's related to all this, and a concept that you can't talk about morality in Buddhism without talking about karma. And karma is something that we usually don't talk about. You don't hear it mentioned very often in Buddhist centers. But it means most basically that a positive action results in a positive result. A negative action results in a negative result. And that's the ideal, if you will. And originally karma was involved with this idea of other lives, etc. That all this bad karma. And so I just know I'm going to be reborn as a squirrel. I've got all kinds of squirrels, you know, running around on the roof up there, etc. But what if you think that there is no future life? What if you're a Catholic who thinks that there is no heaven or hell? And that, and we all know of people who, bad people, who seem to go through life pretty well. We all know good people who bad things happen to, right? And so again, like the precepts, karma is not a simple thing. It's not a simple thing. But it's good to hold on to this idea that positive actions result in positive results, etc. But it's been a tremendous loss, in a sense, because in Buddhism, in Asia, right, India, China, Japan, etc., that people could put up with very difficult situations, oppressive situations, etc., well, they were building, you know, their precepts and positive results because they were going to be reborn in a better situation, etc. And what happens when that's gone? And so again, in the West, we have to rethink what all of this basically is about. Well, every well, maybe 2 years here at the Zen Center, we have a ceremony in which you can actually take the precepts. And usually we take 18 precepts. And I don't know, well, here's a little a rakasu that Marty's wearing. And part of the training actually is to sew that this is, resembles Buddha's robes, etc. And you take 18 precepts. And this is something, if you really become committed basically to a kind of a Buddhist life way, you know, you take the next step and you take the precepts. And what that means is that you're taking a vow. You know, I want steal, I want kill, etc. And there are 18 of these, if you will. Okay, let me end by saying that morality is just one of the six perfections. It's essential but insufficient. That along with morality, of course, you need generosity and you need patience. And my next talk will be about patience, and I'll say it's the most important one. Because without patience, how are you going to develop the practice of the precepts, etc.? And then the next one is effort, and then meditation and mindfulness. You know, unless you sit in mindfulness and observe your mind and the way you are, the way you actually are, etc., you know, you're not going to be aware of basically of your harmful patterns, etc. And then the same thing with wisdom. And I might mention that working with the precepts basically is just part of a broader practice. That doesn't mean we don't do shikantaza, which is our ordinary practice of just sitting and being aware. We might certainly do yoga as part of our practice. We certainly are going to eat well. And so this is just part of a broad practice. So that's it. If you have any questions or comments or anything, don't be shy. Yep.
Thanks for your talk. I appreciate it. And I also wanted to say towards the tail end, you said something about when we beat ourselves up and we say we're a bad person. So it seems like you can take everything that you spoke about today and turn it on ourselves and say, well, I'm not going to kill myself and I'm not going to steal from me and I'm not going to behave these ways to me, and then that opens it up so that you can...
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely, and a good comment. You know, a lot of our practice is, you know, we have to practice intentionally to reach a state where our reaction is automatic. You know, that we don't have to think about, I'm going to be compassionate to this person, but our automatic, the way we are as a person is compassionate. And the way we are as a person is caring and not taking, etc. And so it takes a lot of effort and practice, etc. Any other comments or anything? Yep.
In my workplace, there's in my direct group of people that work together, there's a lot of gossip. And you mentioned being able to be with people and listen to people may involve recognizing the movie that they're living in.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And to realize when you encounter that person, that there's maybe a role you play, whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. So in a workplace where there is gossip and even some sort of undermine one another, being a part of that environment in a positive way seems to necessitate not being a little more able to work outside of the common movie.
Yes, you are. And in fact, there's hardly a situation, you know, like this where you're not going to end up in a muddle. You know, I mean, because, I mean, you know, you people use gossip, etc., to as a form of bonding. You know, you all get together and, oh, you know, you have like you're bonded by your likes and dislikes. You know what I mean? And so if you don't join in somehow, you know what I mean? Suddenly you're strange or you're estranged. You know what I mean? And so this is why I think, you know, this is why you need a wise person or a group just to sit and how are you going to handle this situation? And my experience has been is that you start with this negative thing that I am not going to participate willfully with this, and then through practice, etc., you know, eventually you. People will understand that it's inappropriate to talk that way then when you're there. It sounds kind of strange, but nobody sits there around the Dalai Lama and says, "Oh, that's a gun," you know, etc., or Suzuki Roshi, etc. And so these are all ideals. It's a long way to go, and I know when I finally pass away, etc., I'm going to be in the middle of that river, still pulling away. You know, not crossed. It's very difficult, but at least we can be on the way and be sincere about our practice, etc. And I go back with this Norman Fisher thing about be happy. Be happy the best you can. It makes you happier and makes people around you happier as well. Well, thank you very much.